This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. We're going to begin today with a difficult subject, the subject of domestic violence, and ask the question, is Massachusetts doing all it can to prevent it? The topic is back in the news following the brutal murder of Jennifer Martell at the end of last week. She was stabbed to death, allegedly by her boyfriend, Jared Remy, the father of her daughter, who was at home at the time. The case has attracted attention in part because the suspect is the son of veteran Red Sox player and broadcaster Jerry Remy, but it also raises questions about the way authorities handle allegations of domestic abuse. In Remy's case, he had a long history of violence, including violence against women. Last week, Waltham police arrested him and charged him with battery and assault with a deadly weapon against Jennifer Martell, then released him with an emergency restraining order in place. The following morning, Remy was back in court, but Jennifer Martell did not renew the restraining order, so Remy was released without bail. The following day, Remy allegedly stabbed and killed Martell. So it would seem there were multiple red flags along the way, and yet a man with a record of domestic violence was arrested, released, and then allegedly went on to murder. So what are the lessons here? Well, joining us now to talk a little more about what the state does and doesn't do to prevent domestic violence is Annie O'Connor. She founded the Aftercare Clinic for Victims of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And welcome to Radio Boston, Annie O'Connor. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us by phone is Suzanne DeBuse. She's the CEO of the Jean Geiger Crisis Center in Newburyport, Massachusetts, which is focused on domestic homicide prevention. And Suzanne DeBuse, welcome to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. What's your experience with this subject? Is Massachusetts doing all it can to stop this kind of domestic violence? Do you have experience with this in your neighborhood, in your family? If you have questions or comments, you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Annie, let me start with you since you're sitting right across from me. Could this terrible murder have been prevented in your view?
I absolutely believe it was preventable, and that we need to learn from cases such as this, as sad as it is. I think that we have a number of systems that are somewhat disjointed when it comes to responding to cases of this magnitude.
Say a little more about that. What do you mean a number of systems that are disjointed?
I think we expect that when a woman's being abused, she'll be able to navigate the legal system, the criminal justice system, the healthcare system, the mental health. Any one of those systems independent of themselves are difficult to navigate. But when you put the myriad of the response that's needed for cases such as these all together at once, it's almost a little bit too much to ask a victim to be able to figure out and navigate all that.
And Suzanne, let me come to you with the same question. Your sort of quick take on this question, whether this could have been, should have been. Of course, it should have been prevented. Could it have been prevented?
Well, I like Annie, agree. I think it could have been prevented. And, you know, I do want to say one word of warning. You know, it's always easy to do the Monday morning quarterbacking. But, you know, I think that's in part our job. And our job is to assess how well is the system responding to the needs of victims. And what have we learned in the 30 years of, you know, the body of research that's now been produced in domestic violence homicides? What has that research taught us? And what the research has taught us is that there are some very readily identified red flags that when understood and used in context and when the case is looked at as a whole, then the domestic violence becomes not only predictable, but it becomes preventable.
And from when you've looked at on this case, and I absolutely take your point that we want to avoid Monday morning quarterbacking. There's also a lot we don't know about this case,
right.
But obviously we know this isn't an isolated case, and women are being hurt and abused and killed at numbers that are way too high. But what are some of the warning signs that might have been heeded here that perhaps were not?
Well, I think, I'll start, Annie, and chime in, please. You know, I think that one of the things is that when Jared was arrested on Wednesday night and an emergency restraint order was issued, my understanding, an early report that I read, was that he had held her by the neck and smashed her into the mirror. And any time a perpetrator puts their hands around someone's neck, it's a real sign of potential lethality. And so that's one red flag. The other thing is there seems to have been this kind of almost comfort or some reassurance maybe by some folks because Jennifer Martel did not extend the restraining order, didn't appear in court, that was perceived to be some kind of a sign that she felt that it was okay and that she could handle this. And, you know, what we know in the field is that there are a lot of reasons that victims may not follow through, and one of them might be because they know it's the most dangerous time and they're worried about retribution. And so those are just really quickly the first time, you know, the first read that I took were those two things immediately. Mm.
And Annie, let me follow up with that with you and this idea that someone doesn't take out a restraining order themselves. In this case, there were certainly red flags about the suspect. Was there something more the authorities could have done, even if the victim said, no, I'm not going to take out a restraining order?
Yeah, sure. I think the research really speaks well to this, that women are overwhelmed by approaching our systems and trying to navigate them. So I said that earlier, and I just want to reiterate that. But what we do know is that we can put in some safety measures and have some discussion with these women about options and choices they have, but they can only really absorb that when they're safe. Mm-hmm. She wasn't really in a safe place with him being released. We have no idea what the conversation was back and forth with them, but she is absolutely the type of patient, and they're patients in my world, that we want to wrap our arms around and begin to start providing some of those services to and those options.
But I guess what I'm asking, and Suzanne, chime in here too, is what resources are that the authorities have at their disposal. In other words, could they have kept Remy in custody pending a dangerousness hearing, for example?
Yeah. So I'll start. So absolutely. So some of the tools that could have been used by law enforcement, and I'm not saying that these exist in the Waltham Police Department, but generally you started the show by asking the question about, you know, what are we doing right in Massachusetts and what are some of the things. So there are a lot of law enforcement agencies in Massachusetts and across the country who are using on-scene risk assessment tools. And so that is a tool that law enforcement can use. They're called to a domestic violence incident. They are interviewing the victim, and they ask a series of questions and that help them identify what's the potential lethality, what's the potential for lethality or even just grave physical injury in this case. And when they identify that there is a victim that's in potential, you know, harm's way, they can then put them in touch with victim services. I don't know that Jennifer Martel actually was talking to anyone, any domestic violence advocate. I haven't seen any news report saying that she had been. But that's one, you know, we know that's a protective factor against homicide. We also know, so that's one thing, is on-scene risk assessment. The other thing, of course, dangerousness hearing. Dangerousness hearings need to be requested by prosecution, and a judge needs to rule on it. In order for prosecution to ask for dangerousness hearings, there's a lot of things that have to happen. But the very first thing is they need to have some decent tools that are coming from law enforcement. So what is the quality of the reports being produced to the DA? You know, do they have the information that they need to go for a dangerousness hearing? So that's another key piece. And then, of course, is the judge going to rule yes or no? Mm. The other thing is, you know, obviously GPS. You know, we've used it in the Newburyport District Court occasionally when there has been a high danger offender, and we have used GPS as a way to bridge that very dangerous time between arraignment and trial, and that has been effective. So there are some effective tools.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you on this subject. Is Massachusetts doing enough to stop domestic violence? Is your local community, do you have experience with this issue in your neighborhood or your family? You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Annie O'Connor, give us a little snapshot, if you will. How well, where is Massachusetts sort of in terms of handling this problem relative to other states when it comes to domestic abuse prevention? How are we doing?
Well, I can speak particularly to the healthcare system, and we are working really hard to get this right because, at least at Brigham and Women's Hospital, we have heard from patients that come into our emergency department of all the obstacles that they face in being safe. And we have recognized that in a coordinated approach type of model with law enforcement, with community-based organizations and criminal justice, that we actually might be better situated in the future to really wrap our arms around all the services these women need and move forward. So we, like Suzanne just mentioned, lethality assessment tools. Dr. Jacqueline Campbell is done 30 years of research in this area, and one thing that she tells us in her research shows us is that a woman who is choked is 6 to 8 times more likely to die of a homicide. So when I heard that as well, Suzanne, that she was choked, I thought, oh my goodness, what a missed opportunity there, because the data clearly speaks to the danger.
And Suzanne, Annie's talking about this research from Johns Hopkins University, if I have that right, and I gather there are a number of top sort of lethal risk factors in domestic violence, including a partner trying to strangle them, a partner threatening to kill somebody, someone who's extremely possessive and jealous, has access to weapons, or someone who has sex forced upon them. I mean, those are the kinds of things we're talking about, right? That mean watch out.
Right, right. Those are, you know, they are the top lethal factors that that came out of Dr. Campbell's research. And it's interesting because in the Newbury, we have the domestic violence high-risk team in Newburyport, and we're in our 9th year, and in 75% of all of our high-risk cases that we've screened in, 75% have had strangulation as part of this. So strangulation, to me, has just become almost the top factor. That's not research. That's just anecdotal. Mm-hmm. But, the other thing that I think is interesting that Massachusetts does do well is because we do have the dangerousness hearing. You know, we do have the statute that allows for dangerousness hearing. We do have GPS that was once used pretty primarily just for sex offenders. Now a few years ago, it was really Carrie Healy really wanted to make sure that domestic violence cases were able to use the GPS statutes as well. She worked hard on that. And those are two things that Massachusetts does well. You know, we have those in our toolbox that in our training across the country, other states don't have them, and they're working hard in their own legislatures to figure out how to implement similar things. So I think that is, you know, that's a check mark in the what is Massachusetts doing well.
And Suzanne, let me stick with you and bring up a point that Annie also raised, and she talked about a coordinated approach, and I wanted to get you to explain a little bit about what the Greater Newburyport High Risk Response Team does. This is something that you set up, and if I understand, this is a center that uses an approach that is all about a coordinated response to this, right?
Yeah. After a very similar tragedy in our own community 9 years ago, after one of our clients was murdered, we created this model, and it was really using the research from Dr. Campbell. And the question to us that we asked ourselves was, if we know that domestic violence is preventable or predictable, is it also preventable? And if so, what do we need to do as a community to make sure the next time a high-danger client comes through our doors, we're going to be able to respond differently? And it's not rocket science, but it's really about getting law enforcement and the healthcare system and batterers intervention groups and the court and probation and parole. And we all get together in a room once a month, and we talk about cases. And we talk about cases that have either come through the ER or through, a 911 call or through, one officer's experience in a local high school. And we began to identify some of those high-risk cases and monitor them. Mm. And it's been very successful.
And Annie, that seems to be an example of exactly what you're talking about when you talk about a coordinated approach, so that you really have different people who are involved in different sort of moments in what could be a tragic history coming together and preventing the tragedy.
Yes, and here in Boston, we just received a grant from the Office of Violence Against Women to actually replicate what Susanna is describing in the Boston area in Brigham and Women's Hospital as part of that grant. And so we're hoping, as we identify these cases, to do exactly what Suzanne's done.
Mm. Well, let's take some calls from listeners. Listeners, you can join the conversation. We're talking about best approaches here to avoid the kind of tragedy that we were talking about at the end of last week, the awful death of Jennifer Martel. What do you see in your community? What do you think needs to happen to stop this kind of domestic violence? 800-423-8255. Let's go to Peter, who's calling from Worcester. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. My question is, why do boyfriends and husbands get so much special consideration when they beat up or murder their spouses or girlfriends? If a stranger accosted me in my home or on the street, the police would act swiftly and look for the perpetrator, and if I were able to identify the person, they would then arrest that person and press charges.
Mm.
I don't understand why there have to be so many agencies that a victim, a female victim, has to go through. They have to go through the mental health system. They have to go through the police system.
Peter, I think you put the question really well on the table. Let me get Suzanne and Annie to answer. Suzanne, what do you have to say to Peter? Sounds like a good point.
Yeah, it's a great point. And, you know, I think one of the things, I think historically when we look at how domestic violence has thrived through the ages, you know, we've had the veil of secrecy, and victims have been taught to be very quiet, and they've been taught by the perpetrators and their boyfriends and their husbands to say, you know, no one's going to believe you. And so victims begin to understand, you're right, no one will believe me, and they become very silent. And so by the time victims reach out, they may need a lot of services. The other thing is, we have really worked hard to walk that delicate line between always giving victim survivors the tools and the options that they need to make decisions that they want to make about their own lives, but also be encouraging law enforcement and courts to treat it like any other crime. Collect the evidence and let it run its course through the criminal justice system. But here, it's a very delicate balance, because most of the time, the victim is still alive, and we still have to worry about her safety, and they may share children, and we're trying to make, you know, custody and visitation go smoothly, and it's really, it's complicated. But I hear your frustration, Peter, and I think, you know, we feel it ourselves at times.
Peter, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Lisa, who's calling from the Back Bay in Boston. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just want to bring up a point with regards to your blaming the victim kind of thing. When a woman is exiled and has to move away from her family because the punishment ends up being on her to be safe, she ends up losing closeness with her families and friends and has to start a whole new life. And meanwhile, the person who has been the perpetrator of the abuse can still function in the community.
Mm.
And I really think that that's not an appropriate response to
Lisa, can I ask you if you are you talking as someone who has experience with this situation?
Yes, we have several incidences in our family of domestic violence.
Okay. Lisa, thanks
but
for the call.
The one I'm talking about in particular has to do with my daughter. And so, you know, she ends up having to move away and try to start a whole new life. And it's not it's not right for the victim to be the one who has to be relocated.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Lisa. Annie, you're nodding your head. I wonder if you could respond to Lisa.
Sure, Lisa and Peter, because Peter, I wanted to say that, you know, when an incident of violence occurs, such as what you were describing, that's an incident. When domestic violence happens, it's in the context of a much larger picture and of an intimate relationship with family members and friends involved. So I think that's what distinguishes it as so very different, is the contextual basis of intimate partner violence versus a random act of violence.
Mm-hmm. And to Lisa's point, this idea that people will end up essentially victimized twice, that is, victimized by domestic abuse, but then the sense of the only safe thing they can do is to move away and to sort of move into exile, is that something you see a lot of?
Right. I see tons of women who are just completely isolated from families and friends because mm-hmm. they've just had it with the abuse, and really give the woman an ultimatum. You either get rid of him or don't bother coming over for the holidays. Mm-hmm. So these women further and further become isolated, which actually gets them to a point of depression, anxiety, believing that they deserve the abuse. And I do want to say that the health consequences associated with domestic violence are very well documented in the literature, that women who are experiencing this have tenfold more medical diagnoses and illnesses than non-abused women.
Yeah. Suzanne, I wanted to get you in on that as well, on Lisa's phone call, which I found particularly troubling, this notion of domestic violence almost leading to exile.
Well, I think Lisa is right on, and I think, first of all, I want to say, Annie, thank you for also talking about Peter's, because that was an excellent response. There are domestic violence high-risk teen model. One of the reasons that we created this is because the client that came to us that was murdered had been in the shelter system and just had reached the point where she felt like, I can't run anymore, and you people need to be looking at him because he's the criminal. I need to be in my own community. And so the question to us was, so if there's a victim who's unwilling to go into shelter or can't for whatever reason, you know, how socially just is it that we require her to leave her community, go into shelter, leave all support systems that she has to stay safe, or her other option is stay with the abuser? And so I think for years we've really looked at the victim being the person that needs to make changes in their life if they're going to stay safe. And I think now is a really important time for us to be looking at, you know, how can we, as part of that system that is supporting victims, help them stay safely in their own communities, whether they choose shelter or not, and while we're holding the offenders accountable.
Suzanne, I want to, and Andy, I want to try to get at least one more call into this conversation. Let's go to Julie, who's calling from Lincoln. Hi, Julie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm a victim of domestic violence. My former husband was brain injured, and so there was sympathy for him, and it took 7 years. Courts to really recognize that it wasn't going to change. And it just, you know, I think as a society, we are not doing enough to protect women of domestic violence, and that there's a tolerance.
There is. Okay.
I was checking out of Costco the other day, and I knew that they were going to get slammed with the tax holiday shopping. And the guy bagging the stuff or putting the stuff in a box joked and said that only his wife would likely get slammed. And I was appalled at that. And it just shows that we tolerate this and that defendants have far more rights than victims.
Julie, thank you so much for the call and putting this issue on the table. Annie, let me leave you. Actually, Annie and Suzanne, I want you to both to respond to what Julie said. And let me just sort of read very quickly from the Associated Press. Attorney General Martha Coakley this afternoon called for a reexamination of the state's domestic violence laws in the wake of the murder of Jennifer Martell. So, Annie O'Connor, when we talk about reexamining the state's domestic violence laws, are you encouraged to hear the Attorney General say that?
I'm thrilled to hear that. I think that as she moves forward on that, she really needs to have the victims come forward and tell us what we need to do to get it right. Mm. Because I think as long as we prescribe the way that's going to be, we may well miss the boat. But if we hear from the victims and hear what their solutions and what their thoughts are, we actually might get it right.
And Suzanne, a final thought from you in the 10 seconds or so that remains about this.
I think one of the best things we can do when we're operating across systems is to make sure that there is ready access to the latest information about cases to everybody involved in a case so that the right decisions can be made when they are before the court or law enforcement or advocates.
Suzanne DeBuse, CEO of the Jean Geiger Crisis Center in Newburyport, which focuses on domestic homicide prevention. Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
And Annie O'Connor, founder of the Aftercare Clinic for Victims of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Annie, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you have been a victim of domestic violence, you can find links to resources on our website, RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk about the nation's largest pharmacy chain, how it's tackling pain medication abuse, and some of the controversy that has sparked. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.